Well, we've got quite a topic this evening. It would take me about 4 or 5 hours. But I've been told you all get up and leave at a certain time. So I'm going to try to squeeze it as fast as I can. Maybe, I wonder how many of you noticed this news item yesterday. Evangelicals, Catholics seek greater harmony. How many of you saw it? Well, a fair number, 40% maybe. I don't know if you realize what an event this is. This is staggering. I've been talking to a few people, and it was front page news in many different cities across America. These are, well, let me see if I can find the names of some of them. John White, president of Geneva College. Chuck Colson, of course. Pat Robertson, Bill Bright, the Campus Crusade, and others have signed an agreement. It says that they will not try to proselytize. In other words, a Protestant now must not ever again try to win a Catholic to Christ. You must accept all Catholics as Christians. This is what these evangelical leaders are saying. We talked a bit about it yesterday morning. I quoted for you, for example, page 1 of Vatican II. Many people, you have false ideas about Vatican II. People think this is a liberal document, it's changed everything, and now the Catholic Church is very evangelical and so forth. Page 1, Vatican II. Vatican II begins with the sacred liturgy. And it says this: it is through the sacred liturgy, principally through the sacrifice of the Mass. The Mass is not a remembrance of a sacrifice back there. It is a sacrifice. It is through the sacred liturgy, principally through the sacrifice of the Mass. You evangelicals, listen to this very carefully. I'm quoting it verbatim. That the work of our redemption is accomplished. So, redemption is not something that was accomplished by Christ, but it is something that the church is in the process of accomplishing. On the contrary, Hebrews 9:12 says, He entered by His own blood, He entered in once into the holy place. What does it say? Having obtained eternal redemption for us, right? Ephesians 1 verse 7, and I think it's about the same verse 14 in Colossians 1, in whom we have redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of sins. But in Roman Catholicism, this is not an accomplished fact. It is something that is in the process of being accomplished. You start out on this journey to salvation through infant baptism. That forgives you of all sin. That makes you a child of God and a member of the church. And outside of that church, there is no salvation. Let me just read you a few quotes. For example, in his infallible papal bull, Unum Sanctum, Pope Boniface VIII declared, quote, there is one holy Catholic and apostolic church, outside of which there is no salvation. It is altogether necessary for salvation for every creature to be subject to the Roman pontiff. Well, Vatican II reconfirms the same thing. The canons and decrees of the Council of Trent, for example, says, this was the sixth session, chapter 9, no one can know with the certainty of faith that he has obtained the grace of God, and anathema to anyone who dares to say, if you dare to say that you know, as John 5:24 says, that you have passed from death to life, that you are born of the Spirit of God. You have, as 1 John 5:13 says, these things have I written unto you who believe in the name of the Son of God, that you may know present knowledge, that you have present possession, eternal life. If you dare to say that as a Catholic, you are anathematized. Because that would, what purpose would there be for the Catholic Church anymore? I'm quoting again from the Council of Trent. And by the way, Vatican II says this sacred council reconfirms all the canons and decrees of the Council of Trent. Okay? It's the most authoritative record of Catholic doctrine you could find. The bishops of the church met together to face the challenges and the accusations and the claims and the demands of the reformers from 1545 to 1563, and these are the canons and decrees that they came up with. And I'm quoting again. Quote, "If anyone says that the sacraments of the new law are not necessary for salvation, but that without them men obtain from God through faith alone the grace of salvation, let him be anathema." And as you know, anathema means excommunicated and eternally damned. And by the way, the Council of Trent contains about 100 anathemas against everything that you and I as evangelical Christians believe. And here we have evangelical Christians saying we're going to join together with Roman Catholics to evangelize the world together. Well, they have an entirely different a gospel than we have. By the way, Vatican II contains its own anathema. It reconfirms all of the 100 or more anathemas of Council of Trent. It contains its own anathema. Chuck Colson, who is one of the main instigators of this, who has been using Catholics for many years in his prison ministry, in his book The Body, which in many ways it's a fine book, he has a lot of good things to say in there, but it is a call for union with Roman Catholicism. And in that book you will find much misinformation about Catholicism, which I find astonishing because he's a very highly educated, intelligent, knowledgeable man. And for example, he says that the Catholic Church does not practice indulgences anymore. Not so. Vatican II has 17 pages on indulgences. And let me quote you from Vatican II. "The Church commands that the usage of indulgences should be kept, and it condemns with anathema those who say that indulgences are useless or that the Church does not have the power to grant them for the task of," listen to this, "winning salvation." That's how you get saved. You're in the process of getting saved, and part of it is through earning indulgences. You know what an indulgence is? It shortens your time in purgatory. At the inside of the church there at Wittenberg, where Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door, inside there were all kinds of relics, including a lock of the Virgin Mary's hair, and so forth, that would earn for you 2 million years in indulgences. And the church still does this today. I mentioned, I think yesterday morning, Bob Shevlin, whom some of you know, who is a former Catholic, was here, I think, Sunday night, and he was mentioning to me that at the funeral of his father, more than $2,000 was paid for mass cards. You go into, if you want to find out what it is, go to a funeral parlor and ask for a mass card. You pay $5, $10, whatever it is, and these cards are then placed on the altar when the priest offers mass, and it shortens the length of time that they must spend in purgatory. Now, that's not gospel. That's not Bible. These people are being deceived. They think they can buy their way to heaven, and in fact, the ticket to heaven that they think they're getting is a ticket to hell. And I think it's an abomination. I think it should be condemned. And we certainly should not have evangelicals saying, well, we will accept them as Christians, they believe in the same gospel we do. Could I name some others? I don't want to shock you too much. Billy Graham, when he received his honorary doctorate from Belmont Abbey, which is a Jesuit college, in his acceptance speech, he said, "The gospel that built this school is the same gospel that I preach." You know that he uses Catholic nuns and priests in his crusades to counsel that those who come forward are sent, if they were Catholics, they're sent right into the Catholic Church. I have newspaper articles from all over the country by this Catholic bishop and that archbishop saying the greatest thing that ever happened to us is for the Billy Graham crusade to come to town, because that's how we get lapsed Catholics back into the church. We have some serious problems, folks. And the Reformation is being denied. There were hundreds of thousands of people who were burned at the stake, and down through history, millions of them. Let me just quote you from probably the most famous words of any martyr, Hugh Latimer. He was the most exciting preacher in England at this time. When Bloody Mary, that's why they called her Bloody Mary, when she, Mary Tudor, when she came to the throne, she brought Catholicism back into England after they had had a brief time of Protestantism. And in 4 years under her reign, 288 were burned at the stake, basically for not accepting a transubstantiation. And Hugh Latimer, the most exciting evangelical preacher in England at the time, was bound back to back at the same stake with Nicholas Ridley, the same place where Bishop Cranmer was burned at the stake. If you go to England, next time you're in Oxford, go to Balliol College and see the place where it's marked, and go around the corner and see the monument and so forth that nobody visits these days. And as the flames began to mount, Hugh Latimer was heard to say to his companion, "Be of good courage, Master Ridley, and play the man, for we shall, by God's grace this day, light such a candle in England as I pray will never go out." It's gone out, folks. You got people denying the Reformation. What was it all about? There were differences that were so great that people were not only willing to die for them, but they were willing to kill them for them. That's how grave these issues were. And they haven't changed. And yet it's being denied today. Now, I launched off into something here ahead of time. Let's open the Bible. Revelation chapter 17. This is the book that I'm working on now, and I think it's going to be very timely if we can get it finished. And I want to just... Time flies. I want to just document this very, very carefully for you. Reading from verse 1. "There came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee..." Look, let me say this, first of all. I'm not out to get Catholics. I'd like to get them saved. That's my concern. And if we've got 980 million people that think that the church is going to get them into heaven, and that's not the way of salvation, and Jesus said, "No man comes to the Father but by me, except you believe that I am, you will die in your sins, and where I go, you cannot come." That ought to concern us, shouldn't it? That's what I'm concerned about. Not to try to prove a point. And if we are told that these people don't need the gospel, then you've got 980 million people who desperately need the gospel who are not going to hear it because someone has been misinformed about it. Now, this, I don't know if you've ever looked at it this way, but I think I can show you this evening that this is one of the most remarkable prophecies in the Bible. And I'm going to stop reading here, and we're just going to have to jump around back and forth in these verses for sake of time. You know that he sees this beast. Well, let's look at the beast. Verse 3, "So he carried me away in the spirit in the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns." And go down to the last part of verse 6 to begin with. "And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration." That's the first thing that strikes you as you read this chapter. John was not shocked by the beast. It was familiar. He had seen it twice before. We don't have time again. I'll stop saying that, but we have very little time. But we can't turn to it. But the 12th chapter of Revelation, he sees the beast for the first time. What it is, it's a red dragon with seven heads and ten horns. and seven crowns. All right? It's Satan. And then in chapter 13, he sees the beast again with seven heads and ten horns and so forth. It's like a leopard, like a lion, and like a bear. And that takes you back to Daniel chapter 7, where Daniel saw this same beast before. He saw three previous beasts, and then the fourth one was too terrible to describe, and it had seven horns. And these horns are ten kings. And we quoted you, I think it was Sunday night, Daniel 2:44, where he specifically says, speaking now of the ten toes of the image, which signified ten kings as well. They're the same as the ten kings that are signified by the beast. And it says, in the days of those kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom that will never be moved. There were never ten kings that ruled the Roman Empire. This is the fourth empire. I'm talking very fast because I think most of you understand these scriptures or are familiar with them. This is the fourth empire. There was the Babylonian, the Grecian, the Medo-Persian, the Grecian, and the Roman Empire. And you say, well, what about there have been other empires. What about Genghis Khan? What about the Pharaohs? What about the Mayan and Incan? What about the Arab Empire that went up and almost took Europe and so forth? Why aren't those mentioned? They will not rise again. There is one kingdom that will rise again, and that is Rome. Rome will rise again, and it must be under ten heads, under the Antichrist, of course. And it is in the days of those kings that the God of heaven will establish a kingdom that will not be moved. But now, John is given some tremendous insights into this. And notice, the beast doesn't shock him. He's seen it in chapter 12, in chapter 13. It didn't shock him there. What shocks him? The woman! When I saw her, he says, I was staggered, I was astonished. And that's where the title of the book I'm working on comes from. A woman rides the beast. Wow. Read the description of this beast. That a woman should be astride this world-devouring, horrendous creature holding the reins and guiding it. Yes, that's staggering. But who this woman is even more staggering. There was a hauntingly familiar look underneath the makeup and the haughty gaze and so forth. There's something hauntingly familiar about this woman. Could it possibly be that this is the metamorphosis of what began as that despised little flock? Jesus said, if you were of this world, the world would love its own, but because you're not of this world, but I've chosen you out of this world, therefore the world hateth you, and you know that for three centuries they were hated and thrown to the lions and tormented and imprisoned and despised and persecuted, and suddenly, under Constantine, the church marries the world. And that began the process out of which came Roman Catholicism, with the popes taking the very titles of Constantine, Pontifex Maximus, Vicarius Christi, Vicar of Christ, Bishop of Bishops, and so forth. And we don't have time to go down the history of this. Who is this woman? That's what we want to establish very carefully tonight, because it used to be accepted who she was. But these men, they would deny that. Absolutely would deny it. I sat in the... I won't be bashful to say it. I respect these brothers in many ways. Christian Research Institute, Walter Martin's organization. And I sat there talking with the staff, and we were discussing these things. And they said, we suppose you think that the Catholic Church is this woman on the beast. And I said, you better believe it. You should have heard the guffaws of laughter, ridiculing laughter, that anybody would believe that anymore. It was in all of the Reformation creeds, from the Westminster Creed, you name them. Well, let's see. John identifies her very carefully. Number one, verse 18, there are about seven identifying characteristics. The woman which thou sawest is that great city. So, first of all, the first thing we understand is the woman is a city. Not a country. You go in your Christian bookstore and you have books in there saying the United States is Babylon. No, the United States is probably Sodom and Gomorrah. because of the honor we give to homosexuals now under our new president and his wife. I call them, I don't want to offend any of you, but I call them Ahab and Jezebel in the White House. I'm sorry. They're very evil people. Maybe we're getting what we deserve. We might be Sodom and Gomorrah, but we're not Babylon. Babylon, it clearly says, is what? A city. It's a city, not a country. It's a city. Now, that's interesting. I wish we, well, I don't want to get in too deep, but verse 5, on her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon, the Great. That's most interesting. Babylon was built around the ruins of the Tower of Babel. Exodus chapter 20 tells us very clearly, God says, you're going to make an altar, you will scrape a little bit of dirt together, and you will offer your sacrifice upon that altar, and if the ground is so rocky that you can't gather enough earth together, then you can pile some stones together, but you must not lift up your tool upon it. You must not carve this or shape it, and furthermore, you dare not, you must not go up by steps. Don't elevate this thing so you go up by steps. God is clearly saying that man's efforts, man's works have no part. And this lamb, or whatever it was that was the animal that was offered, was a type of the Lamb of God, Christ Himself, who would come, who would pay the debt for the sins of the world. And you must not put anything, any tool, your efforts, nothing. It is by grace through faith, not of works. And you know that Israel fell into this idolatry. And you read all through the Old Testament of the high places. They went up into high places. And this is where they worshiped the idols. Now, what does Babel, the Tower of Babel, represent then? It's the ultimate high place. It's the ultimate rejection of what God has said. It is the ultimate works religion. We are going to climb on steps that we of our own making right into the very presence of God. It also is something, so it's man's works effort, works religion. It also is something else. Let us make us a city and a name. So it is the political power joined with the religious power, which is exactly what happened under Rome. And I could document that all down through history for you. I'm doing it chapter after chapter in the book. It's also interesting, for example, I noticed an ad in Scientific American. You'd say, what in the Bible? Now, this is old-fashioned stuff. Babel, Babylon, I mean, and it's talking about the last days. Yes, not too long ago in Scientific American, you had an ad by Lockheed Corporation, and it showed the Tower of Babel. And Lockheed Corporation was boasting of their computers and said, we have undone the Babel effect. What was the Babel effect? God scattered them. He confounded their languages and scattered them. What does the world think we need today? Get everyone back together and all speak one language. And soon you're going to have telephones. You can talk English on the phone. And a friend in Japan will hear you in Japanese or in German in Germany or whatever it is. We're putting everybody back together. To undo the Babel effect, Lockheed said, means we are undoing what God did. And Paul, on Mars Hill in Acts 17, said that God scattered them and determined the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after and find Him, though He be not far from every one of us, and so forth. I noticed we were coming back from Europe, and they were handing out the international edition of Wall Street Journal, and in it was a special insert from IBM. And IBM had the Tower of Babel with high-rise skyscrapers, modern skyscrapers coming out of it. The official poster for the Council of Europe, the Western, the 12 nations in Western Europe, United Europe, is the Tower of Babel with 12 stars over the top. But they're not stars like on the American flag. They are turned upside down, the pentagram, with the two horns going up and the beard down, the goat of Mendes, Baphomet, the symbol of Satan. Somebody knows what they're doing. And the Bible here talks about this woman is Babylon. Babylon will be revived. She's a city. Now, go to verse 2 then. With whom, she's a city with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. Now, wait a minute. how can kings of the earth commit fornication with a city? It doesn't make sense. Well, fornication is a spiritual term. And, for example, of Jerusalem, in Isaiah 1:21, it says, how is the faithful city become a harlot? Jerusalem had forsaken God. Jeremiah 3:9 says, Israel has committed adultery with stones and with stocks, with idols. Ezekiel 23:37, with their idols have they committed adultery. The entire chapter of Ezekiel 16 explains Israel's spiritual adultery in detail. So it's a spiritual term. Therefore, this city must be a spiritual entity. Well, it could be Jerusalem. However, it tells us in verse 9, the seven heads are seven mountains or hills on which the woman sitteth, and Jerusalem is not built on seven hills. Oh, Rio de Janeiro is. Yeah, but it's not a spiritual entity. Is there a city that is a spiritual entity? Vatican City, Rome, claims to be the bride of Christ, claims to be the largest and oldest church in existence, claims to be the headquarters of Christianity. Now, sure, Salt Lake City, they have the headquarters of Mormonism there, but there's a lot more in Salt Lake City than Mormonism. But Vatican City is only, it's nothing but Roman Catholicism. It's the only city that receives ambassadors from nations and sends ambassadors to nations. No other city. When an ambassador goes to Washington, D.C., for example, it doesn't go to the city of Washington, D.C. It goes to Washington, D.C. because that happens to be the capital of the United States of America. But when ambassadors, and they come from every country on the face of the earth, when ambassadors go to Vatican City, they go to that city. It's a city that reigns over the kings of the earth. And I don't think we're going to have time to give you all the quotes and documents. I'm quoting, here's a gentleman that I've debated three times now, Carl Keating. He's a very brilliant young man, a lawyer, probably the leading Catholic apologist. Listen to what he says. He says, I'm quoting from one of his books, he says that Peter's statement, the church, this is Peter, 1 Peter 5:13, Peter says, the church here in Babylon greets you. He says that proves that Peter was writing from Rome. And listen to what he says. This is a Catholic, a leading apologist for Catholicism. He says, Babylon is a code word for Rome. It is used that way six times in the last book of the Bible. Four of the six are in the chapters 17 and 18 that we're reading. And in extra-biblical works, and he names some of the other works, and so forth. It's a city. It is Rome. And I don't know whether you realize it or not, but the Roman Catholic Church used to control huge territories. They were called the Papal States. They controlled all of Rome. The Pope reigned as a secular monarch over these. And it was only in the early 1800s that Napoleon took them away. And finally took Rome in 1870 when Italy became an independent nation. And at that time, the armies of Italy, the independent nation, released the Jews from the ghettos in Rome, the ghetto in Rome. They had been there for centuries. And I mentioned, I think last night, the popes made it the death penalty for a Jew to marry a non-Jew. Down through history, they have slaughtered the Jews. She's drunk with the blood of the saints. She's drunk with the blood of martyrs. It's a staggering picture. Can I tell you just one instance? When the Crusaders, carrying the cross, went across Europe, they left a trail of mayhem, murder, plunder, and one of their main victims were Jews. In the city of Worms, Germany, for example, I'll just mention you one incident. They were chasing and killing every Jew they could find. 800 Jews got to the Catholic bishop for refuge, and they pleaded for refuge. And he said, if you convert to Catholicism, then I can rescue you. And he put them in a huge audience chamber to think it over. When they opened the door to see what their decision was, they were all dead. Fathers had killed their wives and their children and slit their own throats. It was a groom had killed his bride and himself. It was Masada all over again, all across Europe. And when the Crusaders reached Jerusalem, one of the first things they did was to herd all the Jews into the synagogue and set it ablaze. Maybe you don't know these things. I'm telling you history. It's incredible. You cannot imagine, and this is not just in the past, but this carries on into the present. It was the Roman Catholic Church that put Mussolini in power. Praised him, the Pope and the cardinals praised Mussolini as that man chosen by God. They put Hitler in power. They said, never said a word against the slaughter of 6 million Jews, although the Allied forces pleaded with Pope Pius XII, pleaded with him, speak a word. You've got 30 million Catholics in Germany. Half of the army is German. 25% almost of the SS are Germans. Speak a word. You're the infallible Pope. You could stop this thing. Hitler fears if you would speak it for us. And he never did. And all through the war, the Nazis paid the Catholic Church hundreds of millions of dollars. I think $100 million in 1943 alone. Well, this is an incredible picture that came true. This is a woman who claims to be the bride of Christ. And she has a city that claims to be the bride of Christ. And what does it say? She's committed fornication. She has been in bed with the kings of this earth in unholy, adulterous relationships, working for an earthly kingdom. And I don't have time, but I have so much documentation, I can just quote you Pope after Pope after Pope. And the relationship that they had with the kings of this earth. In fact, it says she rules over them. And the popes came to the place where they set up kings. 800 A.D., Leo III, he crowned Charlemagne at Mass on Christmas Day, crowns him emperor. They deposed kings. They knocked them off of their... I forget the Pope's name, but here he is. Frederick Barbarossa, Frederick of the Redbeard, Frederick I, the Emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, and he is groveling on the floor with the Pope has his heel on his neck, and he's pleading for mercy and pledging his faithfulness to the Pope and to the Catholic Church. I could go down through history. It's a city that rules over the kings of the earth. And you say, it couldn't be today. Listen, Gorbachev, as I mentioned, I think earlier, is a multimillionaire today. He has syndicated column in the New York Times, Denver Post, and so forth. And in one of those columns, it was titled, My Friend the Pope. He said, nothing that happened in Eastern Europe, from the unraveling of communism to the bringing down of the wall, would have been possible without the Pope. And you maybe remember Time magazine, the front cover a year ago, I think it was. Maybe it was 2 years. Time passes fast when you get as old as I am. It becomes a slippery slope. But anyway, the title on the front cover of Time magazine was Holy Alliance. And it's the picture of Reagan and the Pope. And it said how Reagan and the CIA conspired with the Pope and the agents of the Vatican to prop up solidarity in Poland and to bring down communism. She's been in bed with the kings of the earth. She still is in bed with the kings of the earth. And Newsweek said back in those days, particularly during the Gulf War, that Gorbachev and Bush consulted the Pope at least once a week. Okay? This is an incredible prophecy of a metamorphosis of what was supposed to be the bride of Christ, despised and hated and rejected and persecuted by the world, as she now owns the world. In 1492, when Columbus came over here, I think it was Pope Sixtus the Fourth, I can't remember. I don't have time to flip to all of the accuracy of this, but you'll find it in the book. But he claimed to own the world. And there was a quarrel between Ferdinand of Spain and the King of Portugal as to who was to get the new world. And the Pope drew a line right down the globe, and he gave Spain to the west. He gave the new world to Spain, and you know that all Portugal got somehow, I don't remember how they got it, they happened to get Brazil. But all the rest of it belonged to Spain. And Africa went to Portugal and so forth. They ruled over the kings of the earth. They committed fornication with the kings of the earth. Well, go down. She has a golden cup in her hand, full of the filthiness of her abomination. Wealth. She's wealthy. And it's wealth acquired by ill-gotten gain. I think I mentioned to you that Vatican, St. Peter's, most of it was built with money that they got from people who thought they were buying a ticket to heaven. You remember Tetzel, who was out selling indulgences that we've got Martin Luther so concerned. That was what caused him to rethink one of the things. And you remember the saying of Tetzel, as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs. They thought they were buying their relatives out. There were popes who made lists of crimes, everything from piracy to murder to incest, you name it. And they had a price beside it. And for that price, they would give you absolution. And the church became wealthy with this in this manner. And I've just told you that you can go and buy a mass card for a Catholic who died, and you pay for it, and they will put these mass cards on the altar and so forth. It hasn't really changed. A golden cup in her hand. This is just a quote from a recent newspaper article. It says, the fabulous treasure of Lourdes, France, whose existence was kept secret by the Catholic Church for 120 years, has been unveiled. Rumors have been circulating for decades about a priceless collection of gold chalices. That's what the woman has in her hand. One of the things the Catholic Church is known for. Diamond-studded crucifixes. Can you imagine a diamond-studded crucifix? Make that out of what was the blood-stained old rugged cross, whose shame and reproach gladly bear. No, you've got wealth now in your hands. Rumors have been circulating about a priceless collection of gold chalices, diamond-studded crucifixes, silver and precious stones donated by grateful pilgrims. After an indiscreet remark, this is how it came out, an indiscreet remark by their press spokesman this week, this is just a recent newspaper article, church authorities agreed to reveal part of the collection. Some floor-to-ceiling cases were opened to reveal 59 solid gold chalices, alongside rings, crucifixes, statues, heavy gold brooches, many encrusted with precious stones. Almost hidden by the other treasures is the crown of Notre Dame de Lourdes, made by a Paris goldsmith in 1876 and studded with diamonds. Church authorities say they can't put a value on the collection. I have no idea, says Father Pierre-Marie Charrier, director of patrimony and sanctuaries. It's of inestimable value. Across the road is a building housing hundreds of antique ecclesiastical garments, robes, mitre, sashes, many heavy gold thread, and so forth. Then the poor father wrings his hand and he says, the church itself is poor, insists Father Charrier. The Vatican itself is poor. And the treasure described is only part of a treasure in one small town. We were visiting Zaragoza, Spain a year ago, and we were there having some meetings. Went into the church of the Lady of the Pillar, called that because Mary supposedly appeared there by this pillar. And so many people have kissed this to gain an indulgence, to gain a blessing by works. So many people have kissed this solid marble pillar. It's indented like that, just from people kissing it. They had to put metal reinforcement on it now. And the little statue of Mary that they put up for Mass, it has a huge skirt. She has 365 skirts. They change the skirt every day. I can tell you that they are embroidered with gold. They are studded with pearls and diamonds. She has roses made out of rubies and diamonds, enough for a new one every day for 3 years. She has a pearl and diamond necklaces, enough to put a new one on every day. I mean, on and on it goes. And you can't imagine, that's in one small cathedral, let alone the wealth of the Vatican and so forth. This woman is wealthy. And yet when a priest suggested that they might sell some, at a bishop's conference, he was a bishop in England, suggested they might sell some of this wealth to give to the poor, it was not very well received, his suggestion. Now, she is the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. I don't have time. I wish, I mean, you can read the book. But, you know, Paul was a celibate. He was a bachelor. He recommended celibacy, but he did not enforce it upon anyone. The Roman Catholic Church has enforced it, and that has caused evil that you cannot imagine. They had a saying for years that Rome has more prostitutes than any other city because she has the most celibates. Pius II called Rome the only city run by bastards. I can name you pope after pope. For example, John X, Sergius III, John XII, Benedict V, Innocent VIII. I can go on and on. They weren't celibates. They had children. and so forth. It was a fraud. I forget the name of the pope, but Frederick II, the emperor, chased him out of Rome, and he took refuge in Lyon, France. And they were there 4 years. And when his curia, his entourage of bishops and cardinals and so forth, when they were at last able to go back to Rome, Cardinal Hugo wrote a letter of thanks to the city of Lyon. And he said, "We want to thank you for your hospitality, but you also owe us a debt of gratitude. When we arrived in this city of yours, we could scarcely find a purchasable sister of love. And upon our departure, we have left you with one brothel from one end to the other." Is it happening today? You've seen some of it. You know that the Catholic Church has paid out about $1 billion so far in hush money to settle out of court. Here's an article, and I have many such articles. You've seen it in the news. Santa Barbara Franciscans report decades of sex abuse. They had to shut the school down there. The Archdiocese of Santa Fe, New Mexico, is going bankrupt, and they're pleading for help from other Catholic dioceses because they've had to pay so much out because of this of the sexual involvement of the priests and so forth. I'm not saying that Catholic priests and nuns are any more prone to promiscuity than anybody else, but they have been forced to live a lie. They've been forced to take an oath of celibacy, which is absolutely unnatural. So you probably don't know, but for centuries, I think until about the 10th century or later, the priests were allowed to marry, but they couldn't have sex with their wives. They could have sex with concubines and harlots and so forth. That was okay, but she is the mother of harlots and abominations. And, of course, the worst abomination is selling people a ticket to heaven that ends up bringing them to hell. If I asked you anything you know about the Catholic Church, you would say, well, they're against divorce as well as abortion, so but they're surely against divorce. You don't know, maybe. The Roman Catholic Church gives tens of thousands. I think in 1990 they gave 61,000 annulments in the United States. Here's a 30-year marriage. I'll just give you one example. 5 children. They're both Catholics. After 30 years, he gets an annulment. Annulment means there was never a marriage because the Catholic Church makes an investigation. They say, well, he was raised in a dysfunctional family and he wasn't psychologically prepared for the wedding. I don't know if you saw it. I didn't happen to see it. But prime time television show, January 6, 1994. Dealt with this issue. There was a Catholic priest who appeared, a canon lawyer, who had told him, "Charlie, there isn't a Catholic marriage in the United States that we couldn't annul." This is an expert lawyer of canon law, Catholic canon law. There were a number of women guests telling of their ex-husbands after divorce seeking annulment so they could remarry in the church. You know that Ted Kennedy is doing that right now. Joseph Kennedy II is also in the process of doing the same thing. There was names, a number of them, and also the Sheila Rauch Kennedy, who was married to Congressman Joseph P. Kennedy and so forth, she was on the program. And the church, the priest says, well, we grant annulments because we are going by a higher principle. That's quite a twist for you. Mrs. Kennedy responded on the program angrily, I'm quoting her, to say that a marriage that lasted close to 13 years a marriage that took place after a 9-year courtship, a marriage that created 2 wonderful children, to say it never happened is to me outrageous. She said, Joseph Kennedy, the congressman, explained to her, quote, but you have to understand, nobody believes this anyway. It's just Catholic gobbledygook. It's the way the church requires that you say these things, so don't take it so seriously. Barbara Zimmerman, who had this happen to her, she said on prime time, quote, well, you know, the church says you can't get a divorce, but we'll annul it, and that'll take care of it. It's slimy, it's sleazy, it's dishonest. It's saying we'll get around our own rules. She's the mother of harlots, the mother of abominations, and she is drunk with the blood of the saints. We're not talking just about the Inquisition. When Napoleon, I'll just give you one quote, when Napoleon conquered Spain in 1808, a Polish officer in his army, Colonel Lemanuski, reported that the Dominicans, who had been in charge of the Inquisition, blockaded themselves in their monastery in Madrid. When Lemanuski's troops forced an entry, the inquisitors denied the existence of any torture chambers. You know, they tortured people. They wouldn't tell you. If you were taken by the Inquisition, you were not be told what the accusation was, nor who accused you. It was a wonderful opportunity if you had enemies, if you had a servant that you'd fired because they didn't do their work properly. Wonderful opportunity for people to get even, because they would never be known who accused you or what you were accused. And you had to confess, and you didn't know what to confess, and you were tortured. And some of these poor people said, I would confess that I killed God if you would tell me what it is that I have to confess. This is history, folks. And it went on for century after century after century, with pope after pope. Maybe you don't like to hear this. I don't know, but I think maybe you need to hear it. I think you need to understand that there were some real issues involved, and that this woman is depicted for us. The soldiers searched the monastery and discovered the torture chambers under the floors. The chambers were full of prisoners, all naked, many insane. The French troops, used to cruelty and blood, could not stomach the sight. They emptied the torture chambers, laid gunpowder to the monastery, and blew the place up. That's to say nothing of the Albigenses, the Valdenses. Some of you know the book, The Pilgrim Church. Alongside of the Catholic Church, here's the Catholic Church forcing everyone to obey it. Alongside were Christians, brethren, who simply tried to follow the Bible. They were called by various names, the Poor Brethren of Lyon, the Albigenses, the Vaudois, and so forth. And they were killed down through history. I mean century after century after century, simply because they would not bow to Rome. This woman is drunk with the blood of the saints and the martyrs of Jesus. I think I mentioned to you that Pope Pius III, somebody says I call him not so pious, but Pius III, he slaughtered 60,000 in one campaign in the city of Béziers, France, where they destroyed everyone, men, women, and children, because they would not submit to the authority of the Pope. Well, I can go on and on, but I've probably gone on too long. They put Hitler in power, never said a word. And then, what did they do? The Roman Catholic Church, it is thoroughly documented. I'm not trying to rail against the Catholic Church. When I see evangelicals who say we believe exactly what they believe, and we want to join with them, and I can quote you, Vatican II says the Catholic Church ceaselessly seeks to bring all men and all goods back under her control. That's Vatican II. When I see this sort of thing happening, we need to find out a little bit about history. Drunk with the blood of the saints, with the martyrs of Jesus. And after the Holocaust, the Roman Catholic Church